By God, we have raised them with pride and dignity.
A general strike has been announced across the occupied West Bank in mourning for Sheikh Khadr Adnan. Protests have been held in several areas, including Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups have mourned what they described as the execution of the senior leader of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, Khadr Adnan. They say they hold the Israeli occupying regime fully responsible for Adnan's murder. Since 2004, Adnan had gone on 6 hunger strikes, drawing local and international attention. Not only did he become a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, but also a symbol for the cause of Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli regime has sent a clear message to the whole world that we will continue killing Palestinians even after their imprisonment. Today, Sheikh Khadr Adnan has set a new level full of pride in the history of Palestinian prisoner movement. After his assassination, the Palestinian people are facing a new stage of struggle. Today, we all must unite and stand against the practices of the Israeli regime for the sake of our prisoners.
All Palestine is sad for the martyrdom of the hero prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan. It was not his first hunger strike. Every time he was courageously declaring a hunger strike to reject the illegal administrative detention that the occupation's regime uses to keep thousands of our people behind bars. Unfortunately, this time his strike came to an end with his martyrdom.
Meanwhile, several protests have been held in the occupied Ramallah in response to the Israeli murder of Sheikh Khadr Adnan. The demonstrations turned violent in a number of areas, namely the cities of Ar-Ram, Al-Khalil and Ramallah, with clashes erupting between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian protesters. Israeli forces fired at the crowds and a number of Palestinians were wounded. The Day of Rage will always be remembered as a day of honor and loyalty to Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who is considered by many here as a national hero.
Every time Sheikh Khadr Adnan engaged in a hunger strike, he insisted that he will not end his action without achieving victory. His definition of victory was either getting released or being martyred. This time, he achieved victory by martyrdom. Palestinians also believe he was an iconic figure who succeeded in bringing another defeat to the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Against the backdrop of that all-familiar soundtrack and amid heavy police presence, pro-Palestinian protesters outside the Leicester branch of the notorious Israeli arms maker Elbit Systems. A short walk into the woods from the demo, members of the Palestine Action Group, donning the iconic Palestinian keffiyeh with one purpose in mind.
I'd like to see Elbit out of the UK. I'd like to see Elbit shut down once and for all in the whole world. But obviously, you know, where we are and what we can do is get Elbit out of the UK. And ultimately, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see Elbit Systems completely gone from UK soil.
Beyond the steel fence and barbed wire, Elbit's UAV Tactical Systems manufactures drones on UK soil. Drones allegedly tested on the captive population of Gaza.
And I was there in Gaza for 2 years. I saw what those weapons do, and they are knowingly making them, selling them. In fact, they are even marketing them based on how much horror they have committed across Palestine and still ongoing.
Members of Palestine Action and other Palestinian supporters have come here today saying they're having to take direct action against Elbit Systems because lobbying the British government through normal channels is futile. And they're calling on people around the world to join their campaign to put an end to Israel's international arms trade.
Elbit, Israel's largest weapons maker, used to host 10 sites across Britain. 18 months of protests and blockades by Palestine Action forced its site in Oldham, Greater Manchester, shut last year.
And it's time. It's time that Israel finally got brought to justice. We've seen enough horror, murder, oppression, occupation, ethnic cleansing. Enough. We've had enough.
The last time Palestine Action tried to close Elbit's Leicester site was 2 years ago. This time, they say, they won't leave until they have finished the job. Saeed Pariza, London.
It has become a well-trodden political path. Press TV being attacked in the British Parliament. This time the mouthpiece was the vice chair of the Conservatives' Friends of Israel.
A shocking report into the online activities of Press TV, particularly their use of a video series called Palestine Declassified, which focuses its hatred on British Jews. Whilst Press TV may be banned from our airways, this foreign state hate operation is continuing online. Can we have a debate at some point on what more we can do to ensure that social media platforms tackle this outrageous content?
In the decade and a half since it was established, Press TV has found itself front and center of Western media attacks. But despite the pressure, the channel continues to advocate for the voiceless, chief amongst them, the Palestinians. The show at the heart of the latest onslaught is Palestine Declassified. Its host, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, gave his take on why the show was such a bone of contention for the pro-Israel lobby.
What we've seen here is a shameless attempt by the Israel lobby in the House of Parliament to whitewash Israel's criminality and lawlessness. And of course, they're very concerned about the fact that Palestine Declassified is shining a light into the murky corners of Israel's activities, and indeed on the lobby that seeks to avoid any criticism of their suppression of the Palestinian people. Palestine Declassified is, you know, very effective. It scrupulously researches all of the content that we put out. And obviously, you know, they're embarrassed by the truth that we are bringing to a wider public. And of course, you know, the traction that Palestine Declassified is now picking up, it's been suggested, reaching well over 11 million people now. So they're doing their damnedest now, it seems to me, to try and close down our success.
Chris has written a stern letter rebuking some of the smears parroted by Andrew Percy.
There's no truth whatsoever to the allegations that you made. I mean, it suggested that, you know, we sort of are a vehicle for hatred towards British Jews. I mean, the programme is doesn't sort of promote hate in any respect, or it suggested anyway, that he should consider apologising for maligning me and for impugning the reputation of Palestine Declassified and Press TV.
As Palestinians continue to live under an oppressive regime, Press TV's fight to advocate for justice will see it targeted as part of Israel's campaign to close down anyone who stands up for the Palestinian cause, a move branded media terrorism. Amina Taylor, London.
The members of the Pakistani parliament are insisting the coalition government to eliminate obstacles in starting the oil trade with neighboring Iran to overcome the country's energy deficiency. MPs' voices were heard during the recent meetings of the parliamentary committees, in which lawmakers stressed upon the government officials to robust diplomacy for aggressively pursuing options to secure waivers on the oil trade with Iran.
We get 1 million liters of diesel from Iran every day. It's called so-called smuggling. And it's, I think, 50 rupees per liter as compared to here. We should open this up. The region has to open up.
The lawmakers recommended that all-out efforts should be made to secure waivers from sanctions on oil trade with Iran.
I've been saying to the government also that we should open up these borders. Because, like, for the first time, Iran-Afghanistan trade is more than Pakistan-Afghanistan trade. And I think if they can have it, and it's benefiting both countries, so this trade would be very good for us also.
According to the data provided by Pakistan's Commerce Ministry to the Parliament, Pakistan's trade with Iran has crossed over $2 billion, covering food, medicines, cotton, and pharmaceutical products.
This is a huge project. We are engaged in talks with Pakistani authorities over this issue, and both countries will manage to come up with a positive solution very soon.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening with each passing day. Experts say Islamabad plans to buy oil and gas from Iran, but wants to do in such a way that it escapes sanctions from the US and other Western countries. Although the bilateral trade between Iran and Pakistan has now reached over $2 billion, however, both sides believe that more efforts should be made to strengthen the trade relations further
and to support the business community of the two countries. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar said there are positive signs that Turkey and Syria could be close to reaching an agreement that would facilitate the return of 3.6 million Syrian refugees to home. Akar talked about the meeting that took place in Moscow between him and Syrian Defense Minister Ali Mahmoud Abbas with the participation of Iranian and Russian counterparts. The Turkish minister said things will not be solved in one meeting after 11 years of strained relations. However, he says both sides are aware that through dialogue they can find common ground.
We got together with the Syrian defense minister for the first time in 11 years. It was an important meeting. Dialogue is the key. Both sides acknowledge this. It is, of course, not possible to resolve everything at once. Naturally, the parties may have maximalist demands, but we are trying to turn those demands into reasonable ones.
Damascus says its main demand is for Turkish troops to leave the Syrian territory, with officials repeating in every meeting that the road to normalization can only be paved by the withdrawal of thousands of Turkish troops from the Arab country. This point was again raised in last week's meeting and stressed by the Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad. He said it is impossible to talk about normalization as the Turkish army continues to occupy Syria's northern areas. But Turkey says its presence in Syria is aimed at fighting terrorism and creating a safe environment for the Syrian people, as well as protecting shared borders, which is Turkey's main concern. Turkey is also worried from a new round of clashes, which could lead to a new wave of refugees.
Both sides have their demands. The Turkish side wants security guarantees. They don't want to see any type of autonomous structure in the northeast of Syria that is led by the YPG group. This is a major security concern for Turkey. And Turkey also has almost 4 million Syrian refugees that it would like to slowly see repatriated in the future. We're still far apart on the demands from both sides for normalization. But this doesn't mean that both sides can't come together on a transactional basis to try to further issues that are of mutual interest.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hoped that he can reach an agreement with Syria before the upcoming presidential and parliamentary election. Sending refugees back is one of the Turkish people's main concerns, and opposition parties are playing the card of Syrian refugees against Erdogan in their campaigns. A normalization of relations between Ankara and Damascus will definitely ease the pressure on Turkey, whether regarding the refugee crisis or armed groups operating in Syria that Turkey sees as terrorists. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iran has successfully tested a homegrown plane engine and its control system. The engine was built by experts of Mapna Industrial Group using the reverse engineering method. The testing process was observed by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, who was visiting the company on the occasion of the International Workers' Day. Raisi visited an exhibition on Mapna Group's technological achievements in the fields of thermal and renewable energy power plants, oil and gas, rail transportation, air engines, electric cars, and so forth. During his visit, the Iranian president praised the company, saying he is proud of the efforts made by skilled workers and experts of Mapna.
We must be proud of this level of work, endeavor, creativity, innovation, skill, knowledge, and technology. Truly, this company is one of the industrial groups that have made us proud. It has also made our country more powerful. They have accomplished a lot, and they have lots of important projects that will be completed in the future.
Raisi described the achievements as significant, saying the company's productions are quality enough to be sold on regional and global markets. In 2022, the Mapna Group won an award for being one of the top three Iranian exporters of the year. In July, the company's technology and engineering exports topped 2.5 billion euros.
The major achievements of the Mapna Industrial Group have once again proof that sanctions cannot hinder Iran's development. Iranians have time and again shown that where there is a will, there is a way. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Paris was on fire for May Day, International Workers' Day, once again. Hundreds were arrested, hundreds were hurt, and tear gas was a constant for hours. The demonstration route was littered with broken glass and fires after cops repeatedly intervened in the march. Protesters targeted banks, insurance vendors, real estate agencies, and sexist advertising. And then the end of the march turned into a multi-hour battle royale.
Tear gas is sadly typical of how our government deals with political demonstrations. French democracy has been tarnished worldwide and appears ridiculous, as it's clearly not based on representative democracy.
Over 2 million people marched nationwide as unions declared May Day the 13th major day of protest this year against a 2-year hike to the pension age, which was rammed into law by executive decree last month. The undemocratic proclamation of the law, combined with the shocking police brutality, had many French people questioning their country's democratic bona fides.
France allows for demonstrations, but the problem is that police don't allow it. We saw that with the yellow vests, and we have seen it again from the very start of the pension protests this year.
Macron has to stop showing such contempt for the people. As a yellow vest, I promise that we will never stop fighting for a real democracy. We want referendums and public participation, while Macron only has fear for the people.
International Workers' Day began in Chicago in 1886 with the fight for an 8-hour workday. It wouldn't be implemented in the West until after their political and financial elites forced World War I, which was largely an effort to maintain monarchical privileges and to forestall socialist-inspired reforms. Protesters insist they can apply enough pressure on the president to get the unpopular law revoked, something protests also forced in 2006. Press TV's cameraman was hit by a tear gas grenade fired by police seconds before the start of a live interview from the demonstration. It appears like a clear case of police targeting media, as tear gas is normally shot high into the air. The cameraman was not badly hurt, as the projectile only exploded after it ricocheted off his leg. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In the limelight.
U.S. Democrats claim to support reining in out-of-control defense spending and criticize Republicans for serving America's most powerful corporate interest while doing exactly that themselves. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay with us. The website of Yahoo News writes, top Democratic lawmakers in the U.S. are holding a fundraising meeting with major arms companies on Thursday, April 27th, as Washington plunges into a budget battle in which concessions to the Pentagon and the defense industry could mean cuts to welfare programs such as food stamps. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, his deputy Pete Aguilar, and Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, DCCC Chair, Representative Susan Delbin, have been selected as the honorees to be invited to the event. The downtown D.C. function, dubbed as Defense and National Security Dinner, is set to raise funds for the committee, which is the campaign arm for House Democrats and is central to their hopes of regaining the lower chamber of Congress. Dozens of representatives of Pentagon contractors, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, SpaceX, Palantir, and General Dynamics, will attend the event. The group includes figures who previously worked for congressional Democrats, such as Shauna Candler, Director of Government Relations at General Dynamics. Chandler spent 15 years as Chief of Staff for Representative Adam Smith, the Democratic Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, and another co-host of the Thursday's event. The event could provide a significant signal about the priorities of the House Democrats as they prepare for 2024 elections and battle Republicans who are demanding spending cuts in exchange for passing critical legislation. It could be a disappointing message to those who want the party to support social justice and progressive reform. A senior congressional aide said news of the fundraiser set off alarm bells among staffers, and the event could be a stark example of senior U.S. Democratic leaders saying one thing but doing another. Democrats claim to support reining in out-of-control defense spending and criticize Republicans for serving America's most powerful corporate interests while doing exactly that themselves. In the coming months, Democratic lawmakers are expected to make key decisions that will affect the U.S. defense industry as they fight Republican efforts to cut government spending. U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says he wants comprehensive cuts, but signals from influential Republicans and analysis by budget experts suggest that McCarthy will protect the Pentagon budget. Democrats can also demand limits on Pentagon spending to protect other government agencies. However, the defense industry will lobby hard to prevent such a development. According to new data on global military spending published recently by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, the United States remains by far the world's biggest military spender. U.S. military spending reached $877 billion in 2022, which was 39% of total global military spending and three times more than the amount spent by China. The 0.7% real terms increase in U.S. spending in 2022 would have been even greater had it not been for the highest levels of inflation since 1981. Dr. Nan Tian, SIPRI senior researcher, said the increase in U.S.'s military spending in 2022 was largely accounted for by the unprecedented level of financial military aid it provided to Ukraine, adding, given the scale of U.S. spending, even a minor increase in percentage terms has a significant impact on the level of global military expenditure. Meanwhile, the Politico magazine reports, over the past 2 years, when Democrats fully controlled Congress, lawmakers twice pushed President Joe Biden to approve more military spending than he had requested. This year, Biden's Defense Department budget request is even higher than last year's final figure. Biden has overseen ballooning Pentagon funding while pledging to shift America's resources away from costly foreign wars. In an echo of his predecessor Trump, many progressives and some conservatives say the president and Congress should finally translate their rhetoric into change. On Thursday, April 27th, Representatives Barbara Lee and Andy Biggs introduced a bill to probe the Pentagon and launch automatic cuts at Defense Department offices that do not receive audits to ferret out suspected waste. U.S. financial military aid to Ukraine totaled $19.9 billion in 2022, although this was the largest amount of military aid given by any country to a single beneficiary in any year since the Cold War. It represented only 2.3% of total U.S. military spending. In 2022, the USA allocated $295 billion to military operations and maintenance, $264 billion to procurement and research and development, and $167 billion to military personnel. Military industrialists and gun manufacturers dominate the U.S. political scene, where any effort to hold them responsible for rampant gun violence is curbed. Moreover, the Huffington Post daily writes mass shootings are commonplace in the U.S. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been 146 so far in 2023, the most at this point in the year since 2016. The nonprofit group defines a mass shooting as four or more shots are killed, not including the shooter. According to data published recently by KFF, a nonprofit research organization formerly known as Kaiser Family Foundation, one in five American adults report having been personally threatened with a firearm. U.S. Democrats and gun safety activists have argued that passing stricter laws would reduce the violence, whereas Republicans and gun rights advocates argue that arming teachers would act as a deterrent. The United States, a country of around 330 million people, is awash with some 400 million guns. Efforts to ban assault rifles have faced opposition from Republicans who are staunch supporters of the constitutional right to bear arms. A Gallup poll from October 2022 showed the majority of Americans are in favor of gun control, with a 57% majority of all Americans saying they want stricter laws covering the sale of firearms. According to a nonprofit research group, more than 12,800 people in the U.S. have died from gun violence so far this year, which means an average of over 114 deaths per day. The latest report by Gun Violence Archive indicates 7,326 people have committed suicide using firearms, and 5,505 others have died in homicides, murders, accidental discharges, and defensive gun use. According to the tracker, as for minors, 79 children aged up to 11 and 456 aged 12 to 17 died in those incidents. The report also says there have been 168 mass shootings so far this year, and that the number of mass shootings have gone up significantly in recent years. In each of the last 3 years, there have been more than 600 mass shootings.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Atlee. The U.S. is continuing its militaristic approach towards nuclear-armed North Korea. In the latest offensive, U.S. President Joe Biden and his South Korean counterpart said Pyongyang would face the end of its leadership if it uses its nuclear arsenal. Why is the U.S. provoking North Korea, who has been on a rapid pace when it comes to developing nuclear weapons? China has reacted, warning Washington and Seoul against provoking confrontation with North Korea. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S., in addition to China, is facing another standoff, namely with North Korea. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Ken Hamon, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University, joins us from New Mexico. Also joining us, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at the International Schiller Institute, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany. I'd like to welcome you both, and I'll first start with you, Ken Hamon, if I may. The President, Joe Biden, couldn't be clearer in terms of what he said. And let me quote him. Look, a nuclear attack by North Korea against the U.S. or its allies or partners is unacceptable and will result in the end of whatever regime to take such an action. It kind of reminds us of the we'll be met with fire and fury or whatever that was that the U.S. President, former U.S. President Donald Trump said. Which one do you think is worse? Are they sending the same message?
Well, I think they're definitely sending the same message. It's just a question of the selection of rhetoric. This kind of threat to North Korea. Of course, you know, the only reason that North Korea is investing its resources in its own nuclear program is to defend itself against the threat that the United States has constituted towards it for 50 plus years now, 60 plus years now, since the end of the war on the peninsula. You know, North Korea is in a very defensive position, and these latest actions by President Biden and, as you mentioned, President Trump before him, simply ratchet up the tensions and are part of, you know, America's aggressive stance trying to maintain its position in East Asia.
Yeah, and when you think that the tension is going to be higher, they keep increasing, Harley Schlanger. I mean, basically, Washington and Seoul have secured this deal, which is called a nuclear pact, from what we understand, which is a the way it's been described, a periodic deployment of U.S. nuclear submarines to South Korea. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Harley Schlanger, but the U.S. has said that it will not subscribe to having nuclear arms in the peninsula, especially in South Korea. But doesn't this constitute that, be it intermittently?
Well, I don't think you can go by anything that President Biden is saying. I agree with the other guest that what we're seeing is a reckless ratcheting up of tensions coming from Washington. And I would urge the people of South Korea to take a look at what Washington and NATO are doing to Ukraine by bringing the Ukrainians into the war that they're trying to wage against Russia. It's destroying that country. The idea that Biden is preparing for a nuclear response to North Korea. You know, this is at the same time that the Biden administration is accusing Putin of threatening to use nuclear weapons, which Putin is not doing. So you add to this that this represents an extension of NATO to the Pacific, the so-called global NATO, which includes the Australian, UK, US nuclear submarine deal. Now the South Koreans, the Japanese are being brought in, rearming Japan. This is all insane. It's based on a U.S. reaction against the fact that China has become a successful economic nation, and that's why it's being viewed as a threat. And I bring up this question of what's happening to Ukraine because the U.S. is saying we're doing this for Ukrainian freedom and democracy, what's happening is they're killing off the people of Ukraine for the purposes of a NATO attempt to weaken or break up Russia. So the people of South Korea would be very wise to look at what's happening in Europe on the other side of the globe and realize having a promise from the United States such as this only means there's a likelihood of a war, which will be a catastrophe for the people of South Korea and of North Korea.
Okay. When our guest there, Ken Hamman, talks about how South Koreans should react to this and take a lesson from what's happening to Ukraine, it makes it sound like South Korea perhaps has sovereignty when it comes to its military doctrine. But correct me if I'm wrong, based on some of the research done here, the South Korea, in particular its military, does not really have a say when it comes to the way that it can react in its foreign policy arena unless the U.S. directs it or approves it. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's exactly correct. The provisions of the relationship between the United States and the military in South Korea are that even in ordinary times, there's a tremendous amount of coordination. A lot of South Korean military personnel are rotated through assignments with American units so that they train together and their functioning is largely integrated. In the event that any kind of hostilities should occur, the command of the South Korean Army reverts to the United States. So in essence, the South Korean Army becomes simply an extension of American military power in the southern part of the peninsula. So the idea that that the South Korean military is in some way, you know, might be a counterbalance or something like that to American recklessness, I'm afraid is not that's not going to work very well. But I do agree that the, you know, the people of South Korea need to be very cautious about what their government is doing, and perhaps rethink the power that they have invested in Mr. Yoon, because he is obviously aligning himself quite closely with American interests, which are not necessarily at all the same as those of the South Korean people.
Yeah, and when you take a look, Harley Steinger, at the U.S., in particular, obviously, Joe Biden, have you detected any statements, any motions, or anything that even rings any kind of diplomacy when it comes to North Korea? I mean, not even an ounce at this point, going on to almost 4 years now in his presidency. Why do you think he has not even made any effort to pursue down that path, just in statements, maybe not making a commitment, but just invoke some kind of a diplomatic overture to North Korea?
Well, I think that's characteristic of his overall policy. Whatever else Biden is, he is a puppet for the interests that are committed to maintaining the United States as the world hegemon, the unipolar order, what Blinken calls the rules-based order, which means the U.S. determines the rules. And countries like South Korea, Japan, Australia become subordinate to U.S. interests. But the idea is that the U.S. is trying to fight these wars with other people's armies. Now, in that context, when you talk about Biden and diplomacy, where's the diplomacy that could have avoided the war in Ukraine? He rejected it. So did NATO. Now the same thing is going on toward China and North Korea. Say what you will about Donald Trump, but he did try to talk to the North Koreans, and there was a brief moment before he unleashed the lunatic John Bolton. There was a brief moment where there was conversation going on with North Korea. There's none of that we've seen from Biden, including back channels. There was a talk of a back channel, which never, as far as I know, never really was activated.
Well, taking a look at what the South Korean president has said, Ken Hammond, it's interesting. He said, Seoul will respond firmly to North Korean provocations, but will keep the door open for dialogue on North Korean denuclearization. This kind of sounds like it's dictating the way that were there to be any talks, North Korea should behave, which is the same error in the approach that the U.S. has made when it comes to North Korea. Why are they not open to negotiations when we're talking about North Korea's firing of these missiles, which has been ramped up in the past year, especially in the past 6 months?
Well, I think that North Korea's missile tests and whatever other military developments they're pursuing, as we've said before, you know, these are their defensive measures. You know, North Korea is threatened. You know, we have American troops in the southern part of the peninsula, where the ROK troops are there. You know, now the United States is talking about having nuclear submarines with atomic weapons on them, making port calls in South Korea. North Korea's obviously, you know, got to do something to try to keep the United States and its you know, its projection there in South Korea from simply trying to get rid of it, trying to destroy it. That's the long-term objective, of course, is to get rid of the North Korean regime, get rid of the North Korean government, get rid of the North Korean state. So I think that you know, when the South Korean president, you know, makes a gesture of sort of saying, well, you know, we'll go along with the United States, but we also want to, you know, leave the door open for possible talks about denuclearization, and then agrees to having these port calls by American nuclear-armed submarines, you know, the contradiction there, it's just barefaced. I mean, it's just the way that they say one thing and do another thing. We see this in American, you know, political rhetoric and political actions a lot, that there's this sometimes verbal commitment to certain principles, and then the government acts in ways that are diametrically opposed to those. So I think that the reluctance to even you know, broach the idea of negotiation of an engagement with the other side just reflects the depth of the anxiety, the depth of the fear that American political elites have of losing their dominant hegemonic position. And I think that you know, they fear, you know, I suppose, starting down some slippery slope that's going to result in a further deterioration of their power. But I think that, you know, it's a very dangerous attitude and posture to maintain.
Well, Harley Schlanger, you talked about the former U.S. President Donald Trump, and you said whatever you think about him, at least he made an effort to speak to the North Korean leader, and that was a positive sign. But when it came down to it, wasn't there also at least openness, maybe, when it came to any type of sanction relief for North Korea, which appears to be one of the things that North Korea is not getting from the U.S.? I think if we want to take a look at that, that is something that perhaps is an impediment. It's stopping any type of perhaps cooling down of North Korea and being more open towards any diplomatic and negotiated type of settlement for this.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. There's a complete hypocrisy. And I wasn't defending Trump. I was just pointing out that he at least had a discussion process. But you're absolutely right. If you want to have rapprochement with a country, you don't start by sending nuclear submarines in their backyard and talking about the willingness to use nuclear weapons to defend your ally in South Korea. The negotiations start by looking at what's the big problem there. North Korea has an economic crisis. It's had it for a long time because of its isolation. You don't solve that problem by making them more isolated, by rattling sabers at them and talking about deliberate action to ensure the protection of South Korea, which wouldn't need to be protected if there was a true rapprochement. I think the hypocrisy of the U.S. policy is now seen by virtually everyone. I'm surprised the South Koreans have been blind to it. You know, I'm not so surprised about the Japanese because they have a whole history of this. And the Australians, well, they're part of the Five Eyes. But most of the rest of the world is moving away from this kind of U.S. hegemon, unipolar order idea where the U.S. makes the rules and everyone else has to submit to them or be targeted for military action. So I think what Biden, you know, Trump, whatever he intended to do, he failed. Biden is not even willing to make a gesture. And I think that speaks very poorly for not just Biden, but the people around him, such as Blinken and Sullivan and Victoria Nuland and the old Clinton-Obama crowd like Susan Rice. All of them are part of the Democratic Party War Hawk faction. And that's not a solution to these kinds of problems.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Ken Hammond, let's just say by some miracle, by something that perhaps the U.S. may do, North Korea is willing to think about getting into some kind of negotiations with the U.S. But when it thinks about getting into that diplomatic arena, there's a precedent that has been set here in the Islamic Republic. We're very well aware of what happens when you get into an agreement with the U.S. on a nuclear-related issue. All they have to do is take a look at that and say, why should we get into an agreement with the U.S. when this is what they have done? Doesn't that serve as a warning sign for North Korea? Were there to ever be a channel opened up that way?
Well, I think the North Koreans have their own experience with that as well. Back in the second Bush administration, there were actually some overtures. North Korea stepped away from some of its research, some of its nuclear development, and there was a program to sort of move forward with negotiations and with providing assistance to for energy development and things like that. And the United States subsequently completely abrogated that, walked away from that, just dropped it like a hot rock. And so I don't know why the North Koreans, would have a lot of faith or trust in American diplomacy. It's been shown to be hypocritical, not just in the relationship with North Korea, but many times in the past. So, the dilemma, of course, is that North Korea would like to be able to, devote its resources to its own economic development, to improving the livelihoods of its people. But it is under constant, relentless pressure and threat from the South, from the United States, which requires it to maintain this military development. And, it's as a long-term strategy, of course, we've seen the United States use arms races in the past to wreak havoc with the Soviet Union. So this idea of kind of just keeping the pressure on relentlessly and constantly provoking the North, it's designed eventually to bring about some kind of breakdown or some sort of systemic change. So I think that North Korea is entirely reasonable in learning from their experience and learning from the experience, as you mentioned, of the nuclear discussions with the Islamic Republic. And the United States just does nothing but pursue its own self-interest or the self-interest of its ruling classes. And, North Korea has to make the best path that it can in navigating that situation.
All right, let's talk about China a little bit here, Harley Schlanger. And first of all, China has said all parties should face up to the crux of the Korean Peninsula issue and play a constructive role in promoting peaceful settlement of the issue. What's very interesting about China in terms of what the U.S. Has said regarding North Korea and also what the U.S. has asked Russia is that it has said both Russia and China should play a role in using their influence on North Korea for it to stop firing these projectiles. Why would China even entertain that thought when the U.S. is after China offensively, militarily? And I'm not going to say, of course, how the U.S. has been after Russia and the way that Russia has responded to this and China.
Well, the Russians and the Chinese know something about the intention of the ruling establishment in the United States. It's not to establish zones of peace and economic development. Everywhere the United States goes, as at the same with the situation before that with the British Empire, people are left impoverished. The idea of the United States is not to have economic development in these countries. If we wanted to, we could do that. And you're absolutely right, starting with ending the sanctions. Sanctions, in my opinion, are war crimes because more people have been killed in some of these countries like Iraq by sanctions than by the actual war. And on this point you were making about the Islamic Republic and the U.S. treatment of Iran, look at Libya. Libya also ended their weapons of mass destruction program, and look what the U.S. did to Gaddafi. So there's no reason for North Korea to have trust and confidence in the United States. And now we're hearing the same thing from Putin. What Putin has said is there's no one to work with in the West. There's no one we can trust because of the level of betrayal. But that's the question of intent. And I think it's really important to understand that the leaders of the United States and both parties, the leaders of most of the political or the governments in Europe, have an intent to maintain the limited sovereignty of nations outside of their own circle. And that's something which is changing now. Countries are demanding the right to have economic development, an end to the colonial and neocolonial system. And the U.S. just keeps doubling down on insisting that we in the United States can make the rules and everyone else has to obey, or we have NATO or global NATO to enforce those rules. And that's not a winning proposition.
Curious to know whether the countries in that region, Ken Hammond, are on board when it comes to what the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, for example, are doing when it comes to North Korea. I mean, surely these countries don't want any type of military confrontation to happen here, especially when you're talking about a nuclear one, potentially. I'm sure they're not all on board when it comes to the U.S. move towards North Korea. Or are they? Or how do you feel the situation is like there?
Well, I think you know there's a range of variation across the region. Some of the governments, and we have to be clear that these are decisions that are being made by governments in power in different countries. Some of the governments, Japan and at the present time South Korea, are aligning themselves closely with the United States. There have been large demonstrations in South Korea, also some demonstrations in Japan, expressions of protest against that alignment, against these new policies, against the rearmament in Japan. I'm sure that there will be concern expressed by many people in South Korea about these nuclear-armed submarine visits that are on the agenda now. I think if you look elsewhere around the region, you can see countries that are very anxious about the American role. Even a country like the Philippines, where you know they're having base agreements with the United States again, but there's considerable unease about American conduct. And when you get down certainly into Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, even Malaysia, Indonesia, these countries are very cautious in their attitude towards the United States. They don't want to totally alienate the United States. They don't want the United States to start seeing them as enemies, because that's a very dangerous proposition. But they're very clearly expressing their desire to find, you know, maybe a middle path, a way not to be aligned so closely with the United States, because they recognize that really the future in East Asia, Southeast Asia, and much